This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Mike Davidson. Today is August 16th, 2004. I'm again in Lubbock, Texas, in the Vietnam Archive interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. It's about 9:04 a.m. Central Standard Time. And Mike, you're again in Lake Charles, Louisiana. Mike, we talked about a lot of the non-personal stuff that, of your tour. I'd like to talk about some of the more personal things that happened to you during your tour. And I have a number of questions for you with that. But first, can you talk to me about kind of your daily life in Cantel? This is where you spent the majority of your time. And what was it like there?
Yes, well, I got to the office at 7:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And spend the day in the office. And at noon, I would come back to the main compound and have lunch, then go back to the office. If I was flying with a general, I would spend the day in a field, which happened about three times a week. Then I would come back at 5:30 for the evening briefing, evening corps briefing. That's where all the corps staff officers assembled,
mm-hmm.
with the commanding general and John Paul Vann, and would discuss what had taken place in the corps operating area during the last 24 hours.
Okay. Can you tell me your impressions of John Paul Vann? What was he like?
Well, he was about 5'6".
Mm-hmm.
He was very dynamic. He was articulate and highly motivated and determined. And knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, I think that his effort in the Delta to pacify the Delta was probably his greatest contribution to the war.
Really?
Why
do you say that?
Because that's where most of the people lived.
Mm-hmm.
And after the Tet Offensive of '68, and after General Creighton Abrams came in, the Delta needed to be pacified, and John Vann did that,
mm-hmm.
along with, of course, my Corps commander, General McCowan.
Mm-hmm.
But in that 18-month period prior to March of 71, was the Delta's greatest success in pacification, which was led by John Paul Vann.
Did you interact with him pretty much on a daily basis?
No. I saw him nearly every day at the Corps staff briefing,
mm-hmm.
and I saw him at Corps headquarters for briefings he would sometimes give to incoming officers on the status of pacification in the Delta.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't ever hold a private conversation with him.
Okay. What would you say, well, what is your opinion, really, then, of his legacy? You just touched on that briefly, but, you know, he's remembered as, a lot of people have mixed views of him. And if I'm hearing you right, you interacted with him and you witnessed a very positive dynamic force for the United States in Vietnam from...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Highly motivated person.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very positive force in the Delta. He really was.
Do you remember how you felt when you heard about his death?
Yeah, I felt that Vietnam was... I kind of had premonitions that it was going to have a tragic ending.
Really? Why?
And
why do you think that, Mike?
Because John Paul Vann had been killed. I know this sounds strange, but John Vann was the one person I felt could explain to the American people what was going on in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
when he came back from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And with his death, that spokesman role was unfulfilled, and Vietnam ultimately had a tragic ending. So... Mm-hmm. Okay. I felt it was a tragedy when he died.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt it was a premonition for what was going to happen in Vietnam.
That's very interesting. Well, tell me a little bit about just about yourself in Vietnam. How much did your religious views change while you were in country, or did they change at all?
No, I don't think it had any impact on my religious views at all.
Okay.
I wasn't, I was a Christian,
mm-hmm.
Presbyterian. I didn't attend church in Canto,
mm-hmm.
but once or twice during the entire year, even though the chaplain wanted me to go more often,
mm-hmm.
But I just wasn't a very strong Christian.
Okay.
At that time in my life, and it didn't, Vietnam didn't have any impact on my religious views one way or the other.
Okay. Mike, what would you do for entertainment?
Well, by the time I'd get out of the general's mess after supper,
mm-hmm.
it was about 7:30 at night, and either I would go to the club and have a couple of drinks, or normally I would go and write a letter to Judy. I wrote to her nearly every day.
Right.
Or I would go swimming in the swimming pool,
mm-hmm.
and lift some weights after I had written my letter, my daily letter to Judy.
Mm-hmm.
I did play a little bridge in the officers' club.
Okay.
But not much. But basically, I was kept busy till 7:30, 8 o'clock at night,
hmm.
with. So before I had any spare time.
Right. Did you ever see any USO shows?
Yeah, I did, but. Just one.
Okay. Did you ever take R&R?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, we got two leaves in Vietnam. We got a 14-day leave and a 7-day leave, 7-day R&R.
Mm-hmm.
I took my first 14-day leave in January of 1971. As you know, Judy was living in Honolulu,
mm-hmm.
so I went back to Honolulu. I didn't have to pay for my flight. I got a Space A flight to Honolulu,
mm-hmm.
and a Space A flight back to Vietnam. We saved a lot of money.
Do you want to explain what that is for people who are listening to this, don't know what that is?
Well, it just means that there was space available on the airplane,
right,
for me to get a ride. So
okay,
that's called a Space A flight.
Mm-hmm. What was it like in Hawaii seeing Judy?
Oh, it was wonderful. I'd been away from her for 6 months, and it was just fabulous to be with her and my son Van again.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't do much. I mean, we just kind of renewed acquaintances and went out to eat some. But we didn't do anything special other than just be together.
Right. How was it when you had to leave and come back?
Oh, leaving was just heart-rending. I mean, it just tear you up inside to have to leave your family and go back to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very uncomfortable feeling.
Yeah. What about the 7-day leave? What was that?
Well, that was in May of 71,
mm-hmm.
and we went to the Big Island. We flew to the Big Island of Honolulu,
mm-hmm.
and stayed at the Armed Forces Recreation Center at Kilauea. We toured the volcano,
mm-hmm.
And we just spent 5 or 6 days on the Big Island of Hawaii.
Okay.
With Van.
Right.
So.
And how old, he was what, two at this point?
No, he was, about 13 months old when we were in Kilauea.
Okay. I bet it was nice to see your son.
Oh, yeah, it was. It was great.
Tell me, Mike, about the relationship with the men that you had there in your unit there in Kanto. How were you accepted, and how did you get along with everybody, and what was your opinion on them?
Well, first of all, I had a Navy lieutenant that worked for me,
mm-hmm.
Who was sort of like the deputy or the XO of the office,
mm-hmm.
We had a wonderful relationship. His name was Ed Gronert,
mm-hmm.
and we really worked together well, closely. The whole year. So, I mean, it just, he was always there to be a big help. And he made sure the newspaper got out,
mm-hmm.
every month. He had the most direct interaction with the men,
mm-hmm.
and he sort of ran the office.
Okay.
As for the other ones were enlisted men. I had a sergeant by the name of Sergeant Matt Glasgow,
mm-hmm.
who came in September of 1970,
mm-hmm.
who had 3 years in country as a journalist. He was a wonderful writer, and he was the one that sort of took over editorialship of the newspaper and did such a wonderful job with it.
Mm-hmm.
He left in I believe it was March of 1971. I don't know where he went. I think he stayed in country somewhere, but he didn't work after March of 71 for us. Then I had Sergeant First Class Bartley, I think was his name.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't very good. And I had a driver by the name of Sergeant John H. Winbush.
How do you spell his last name?
W-I-N-B-U-S-H.
Okay.
And he was my driver. Because of the discipline standards were very low in Vietnam, one of the things I insisted upon since I was an officer was that I be driven around in a Jeep.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't drive my Jeep. I made somebody drive me.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of like an officer's perk that I just insisted upon. Anyway, John Winbush was my driver and drove me everywhere around Kanto and sometimes up to Ben Tui Air Base, and
mm-hmm.
and anyway, John Winbush was my escort, compatriot, and a driver.
You guys got along well?
Yeah, we did. We got along fine.
Okay. How did you get along with all the other enlisted?
Oh, I did fine. I didn't have too much interaction with them. Ed Gronert, my assistant, did.
Mm-hmm.
Early in, I believe it was November, we had a discipline problem with one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And we referred it for disciplinary action to the headquarters commandant.
Mm-hmm.
But not much happened.
Mm-hmm.
So we just...
What happened? What was the discipline incident?
He was being insubordinate to Ed Gronert,
mm-hmm.
my lieutenant. So, I had a sergeant, an Air Force technical sergeant, who was a photographer,
mm-hmm.
who ran the photo lab, the little photo lab that we had,
mm-hmm.
who made pictures. And he was very good. The men just did their jobs. They would go out and get their stories about pacification for the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And we pretty much let them have their head. So they did pretty good work.
Okay. Did you ever experience or witness any race issues?
Miss Black America came to the Delta.
Mm-hmm.
And we sent a photographer there to photograph her. And the gathering that she had with some of the troops. Mm-hmm. Anyway, one of the troops stuck his fist up in the air, and my photographer made a picture of it, mm-hmm. and that picture made it into the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And General Cushman didn't like that at all. He thought it was a Black Power salute. And I didn't think much of it one way or the other, but when I came back and told my writers about it, they were all upset with him. So, in fact, General Cushman chewed me out about it. So,
really?
Yeah.
Why? Was he upset because he thought it might incite some
racial? Yeah, I think so. I think he thought it was insightful.
Okay.
But I didn't think that at all. It's just, you know, it was just a picture of what happened in the at the little ceremony that they had with the Miss Black America. So mm-hmm. I didn't think anything about it one way or the other.
Okay. Were drugs or alcohol ever a problem in Vietnam that you witnessed?
Not alcohol. We did have some people who were using drugs on the compound, and every once in a while there would be a search. To find out who, if anybody had any illegal drugs, but it was mostly confined to the enlisted men.
What kind of drugs were they? Do you remember?
Marijuana and heroin.
Okay.
About August of 1970, heroin came into the Delta, and it was being sold in little vials, little glass vials with a black plastic top. And each vial was about as big and as long as your little finger, and each one cost $1.
Hmm.
So it was really cheap, pure heroin.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought that the North Vietnamese were bringing this stuff in. But it was being sold on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
By young Vietnamese boys.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. Mike,
that was quite a problem.
It did become a problem.
Yes, it was.
Okay. Were you, of course, your unit's not in charge of getting rid of that problem, but what do you remember what was done about it?
Well, not much was done that I saw directly.
Mm-hmm.
Not much was done.
Okay. What kind of music did you listen to over there, Mike?
Well, we listened to Armed Forces Network
mm-hmm.
Radio,
mm-hmm.
and it played records from the 50s and 60s, and it was just a fabulous radio station because of the music that it played.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked Armed Forces Network Radio.
Do you remember any songs, anything that in particular that comes to mind?
I remember I used to sing John Denver's Country Road all the time because I was trying to think about going home.
Mm-hmm.
What
do you hear on the radio today that takes you back there?
Leaving on a jet plane.
Mm-hmm.
I think by Peter, Paul, and Mary, I think was saying that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's about all.
Okay. Mike, did humor play a role in your daily life there in Canto? I've heard that humor was so important to surviving that year in Vietnam. Was that a factor with you?
Not that I remember. I didn't think anything was particularly funny. Anyway, no, I don't think so.
Okay. Did you ever hear about or witness any homosexuality, anything like that?
No, nothing.
Okay.
Didn't hear about it, didn't witness it, didn't have anything like that.
Okay.
In fact, there was sex was available downtown. So readily that anybody could get anything they wanted downtown.
Through the prostitution?
Yes.
Massage parlors, things like that?
Right.
Okay. What, you said you didn't interact a lot with the civilians, but tell me about the folks in Canto, the Vietnamese. Were they different from other places you visited in Vietnam?
Well, the only other place I visited in Vietnam was Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't seem to be big city people.
Mm-hmm.
They seemed to be small town people. I guess that's the biggest difference I saw between Saigon and Canto.
Okay.
Did
you form any relationships with any of the Vietnamese civilians or military?
I did with with my secretary, Miss Lauren. She was pregnant at the time, and I brought her back a big bottle of vitamins for her to take every day, which I had to talk her into taking, but had to convince her it was like food to get her to take them.
You brought it back from Hawaii?
Yeah.
Okay.
Then there was my the maid, the cleanup lady at the press camp.
Mm-hmm.
Was named Bayou. She had a sister whose name was Koot, who used to come to the press camp. Koot had, her husband had been an Arvin captain who had been killed in combat, and she came and came to the press camp several times. I became pretty good friends with her, and on Sunday afternoon sometimes I would go to her house and sit on the porch and just talk to her.
She spoke pretty good English?
Yeah, she did. So,
what would y'all talk about?
Oh, family, and what was going to happen after the war, and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Was she optimistic?
I think fatalistic was more a better term for it. I mean, she had suffered a tremendous loss with the death of her husband, and I think she was just fatalistic about her view about what was going to happen in the future.
Right. Tell me about leaving Vietnam. When you were getting short, did you change your activities any?
Well, once I started getting short, I didn't fly in helicopters as much.
On purpose?
Yeah, I just kind of felt like I'd flown enough in them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I didn't go around with the general as much as I had earlier in the year. Although it wasn't because I was scared to go with him. I didn't have to go, and I didn't take advantage of the opportunities a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway.
How did you leave Vietnam?
flight from Tonsonuke back to Honolulu.
Okay. Was this a commercial or was it military?
Military contract flight.
Okay. What was it like on the plane leaving, flying out of there?
Oh, it was really something. I felt like an adventure had come to an end. I can remember thinking that as the plane was taxiing down the runway.
Uh-huh.
And I felt really good that I was out of a war zone.
Uh-huh.
I just felt relieved, I guess, was the best way to put it.
Mm-hmm. How about the flight back? What was the mood on the airplane?
Somber. It's a long flight between Honolulu and Vietnam. It's about 13 hours, 6 hours to 7 hours to Guam and 6 hours to Honolulu.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a long flight. Anyway, it was just somber the whole way.
And Judy and Van were waiting for you in Honolulu?
Yes, they were.
Okay. Did you have trouble at the airport when you came in, or?
Never did.
How about when you came back into the States?
Didn't have any trouble at all.
Okay.
Nobody harassed me or anything like that.
Okay. Did you have any difficulty transitioning back to life stateside?
Yeah, I did. I felt like when I got back to Honolulu and picked up my family, and we flew from Honolulu back to California.
Mm-hmm. When was this, Mike, exactly?
June of 71.
Okay.
Then I started interacting with the American people again, and just people at the airport and
mm-hmm.
people I was seeing on the street. And, I was really disgusted with the United States and the people in the United States because I felt like there was a struggle for freedom going on in Southeast Asia, and people didn't have a clue about what was going on because of the news media reporting.
Mm-hmm.
Felt so many people were overweight and fat. You know, the Vietnamese are very, very thin and
mm-hmm.
skinny. I felt sort of disgusted for quite some time.
Really?
Yeah, I read nearly every book that Eric Hoffer had written,
mm-hmm.
and it made me feel better about America. So it sort of faded, and that was the last of it. I mean, it lasted about a month.
Okay.
And it went away.
What about Hoffer's books appeal to you?
His Celebration of America.
Mm-hmm.
As a good country to live in.
Mm-hmm. What about the anti-war movement? What did you witness, and what was your opinion?
I didn't witness any anti-war demonstrations or any war activity at the airport or anything like that. I felt they were terribly wrong and were helping the enemy. So I didn't think much of them at all.
Mm-hmm.
And once I had been in Vietnam and come back from Vietnam, I realized that they were basing their opinions based upon what had been reported by the news media.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that didn't reflect the reality of Vietnam at all. And I felt kind of strange being around them because I felt like I knew what was going on in Vietnam. And they didn't, and yet they had these lifetime opinions of anti-war activity, which only helped the enemy, and yet I felt they were terribly wrong.
How much did you talk about your Vietnam experience? Did people ask you about it?
Yeah, in a very cursory kind of way. I didn't talk about it much. Around people other than family.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Did Judy ask you a lot?
No, not really. No, not really. She, no, not really.
Okay. How much did you keep up with what was going on in Vietnam when you left?
Oh, after that, when I came back, I tried to keep track of I read the news articles again, mm-hmm. you know. But I was transitioning to law school, so I we had to go up to Oxford, Mississippi, and find a place to live and get our household goods, what remained of them, and get some furniture, because all our household goods had burned in a warehouse fire in Fort Bliss, Texas.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
We had to get some furniture to put into an apartment in Oxford, Mississippi. So we were busy during that summer.
Mm-hmm. What was your, you stayed in the military, and what was your duty? What was your job?
Oh, after Vietnam, I had resigned my regular Army commission, and mm-hmm. I was in the reserves.
Right, right. And you went to law school. You went and fulfilled that, correct?
What?
You went to law school.
Yes, then I went to law school.
Okay.
At University of Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
which was a conservative school. And there were about five or six returning veterans in my law school class.
Huh, okay. The first
semester there was 360 freshmen, and they flunked out about 60% of those the first semester.
Wow. Did you and the other veterans discuss your experiences in Vietnam?
No. No, not really.
Why not?
I felt like that Judy and I had three hard years, and law school was an opportunity to renew acquaintances and to live a quiet life in Oxford just with law school studies and my little family, and that's all I really wanted to do. So
mm-hmm.
That's all we did.
Right. Well, tell me what your opinion was in 73 when the United States pulled out and then leading to April 75. What did you think about what was happening over there in Southeast Asia?
Well, I can remember when the 1972 offensive started. It had an adverse impact on my grades because I was really worried about the South Vietnamese and how they would do. So I was worried about the 72 offense.
Mm-hmm.
I kept my Viet Cong flag and I hung it up in my room where I studied.
Mm-hmm.
When President Nixon authorized the bombing of Haiphong and Hanoi with the B-52s, I cut out the headlines from the Memphis Commercial Appeal newspaper and pinned them up on the on that Viet Cong flag. So, yeah, I kept pretty close track of what was going on in Vietnam as best I could.
Did you think
Although I was always very skeptical about what the news media was reporting.
Right. Because of your experiences.
Right.
Yeah. Did you think the United States achieved peace with honor, as Kissinger said and Nixon said when we got out in 73?
I felt that we had done the best that we could do to give the Vietnamese a chance to survive.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel like we needed to be there much longer. It was the Vietnamese's fight, and South Vietnamese's fight, and they had to fight it and win it.
Mm-hmm.
So I I thought the government policy was correct,
mm-hmm.
which led to the withdrawal of American troops.
Okay. Do you remember how you felt in April 1975 when Saigon fell?
Say that again, please.
Do you remember how you felt in April 75 when Saigon fell?
I was absolutely sick. I was in Germany in Neu-Ulm, Germany, serving as a prosecutor in the 1st Infantry Division,
mm-hmm.
and I was absolutely sick when I got word that Saigon fell.
Mm-hmm.
Even shed some tears about it. So I mean, it just I felt terrible.
Did you feel somehow personally responsible?
What?
Did you feel somehow personally responsible, or was it more of a that the United States as a whole had failed?
The United States as a whole had failed.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really disgusted with the United States for letting it happen. So,
what do you think went wrong? What about U.S. policy over there in Southeast Asia all those years, from 54 all the way to 75?
Well, I think that I think, first of all, the decision to have a coup against President Zim
mm-hmm.
in November of 1963 was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
There was nobody else to take Zim's place. And the internal cohesion of the Zim government, of the South Vietnamese government, came apart after Zim was killed, which led to our greater involvement in Vietnam. I felt like that was the first mistake.
Mm-hmm.
The second mistake was once that had happened, was the decision to Americanize the war from 1964 to 68.
Mm-hmm.
Without encouraging the South Vietnamese to take over their own defense and arming the South Vietnamese with the latest weapons and all that, which, I mean, just the idea of Americans taking over the war farm to fight it was, I think today, was a terrible mistake because we traded casualties with the North Vietnamese, which we weren't able to withstand for a very long time, and we soured the American body politic on Vietnam
mm-hmm.
during that period, and it was irretrievable after 1968 in American public opinion. So I think that was the biggest mistake. Then from 73 to 75, I think Congress's efforts to cut off funds to support the South Vietnamese and military and to prohibit the use of B-52s over Indochina
mm-hmm.
Took the underpinnings of the Paris Peace Accord of 1973, knocked the props that were holding up that peace agreement out from under it, and it was inevitable that South Vietnam would fall after that.
Okay. What do you think we could have done differently? Not get involved at all? Or if we did stay involved, what could we have done?
I think it should have never been anything other than an advisory effort
mm-hmm.
In Vietnam. I'm not even sure. About bombing the North or manning the North or doing anything like that. I felt like we should have helped the South Vietnamese, but we shouldn't have got involved to the depth that we did in Americanizing the war, because it was always the South Vietnamese war to win or lose.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we should have done differently in that period from, well, first of all, I don't think we should have had a coup against President Zim.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, we shouldn't have Americanized the war. So.
Okay. Well, Mike, looking back on your service in Vietnam, how do you feel about what you did there today?
I'm very pleased with it because I felt like, number one, General McCown complimented me with the Secretary of the Army in May of 1971.
Mm-hmm.
He told the Secretary that I was the best information officer in Vietnam, which made me feel good.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me feel like that I had a good tour.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got a real good efficiency report from General McCown for my work that year.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like that I had a successful tour in a war for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I did my duty in a war zone about as well as it could be done.
Okay. Is there anything that you would change about your service if you could?
Say that again.
Is there anything that you would change about your service if you could?
No, I don't think so. I don't think I'd have done anything any differently.
Okay. What do you think was the most significant thing you learned while you were there?
The most significant thing I learned was, I think, was to watch the American government in a war zone try to pacify the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the most significant thing I learned was I felt like the American government and the people that are in it have an awfully big and good heart to try to help the poor South Vietnamese people overcome the insurgency in their midst and lead them to a better life with schools, roads, and dispensaries and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was duly impressed with the American government's effort in South Vietnam.
Okay. How do you think the war has most affected you personally?
Oh, it profoundly affected me. It really did. I came back with a view of the news media that was just about unprintable.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like a stranger in my own country because I felt like I had seen the reality of Vietnam and it was entirely different from what the news media was reporting.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like it just made me a stranger in my own country that I couldn't believe the news media anymore. Once we failed, once Vietnam failed, began a period of intense intellectual curiosity for the reasons for the defeat. And I started reading just about everything I could find on Marxism, Leninism, and military history and military theory.
Mm-hmm.
So to try to better understand what had happened and yet to do my part to see that it didn't ever happen again.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what did you learn? from reading all of that about the enemy and about what had happened?
Well, I felt like that the North Vietnamese had successfully imposed their will and their version of history on the American intellectual class for a multitude of reasons, not the least of which was because of the mismanagement of the war between 1964 and 68 and the Tet Offensive of 68. And how that happened and the reasons for it, I felt deserved considerable historical study. Because we went from, when the war started, you know, the New York Times supported it, but probably by 1967 they started backing away from their support of it and then became an anti-war rag. So also I learned a lot about Marxism, Leninism, and communist theory, communist systems, and the terrorism that communist systems use against people. It made me a fierce anti-communist. My service in Vietnam did, because of being exposed to some of the terrorism that the North Vietnamese used against the South Vietnamese people, and hearing about it on a daily basis, I began to think that, you know, communists were just animals. So, anyway, I was deeply worried about the ability of the American people to support a war effort because of the success the North Vietnamese had had against the United States.
Mike, do you suffer any disabilities from your service in Vietnam, any PTSD incidents, anything like that?
No, I sure don't.
Okay. Well, what do you think the United States took away from Vietnam? Were there lessons learned?
Yes. One is to use overwhelming force to achieve the military objective as soon as possible before the center of gravity of the struggle shifts from a military conflict in the theater to a political conflict in Washington, D.C. That's what I think I learned, and that's what I think the country learned. And we saw evidence of that in the first Gulf War, where we used overwhelming force to defeat the enemy in 100 hours. So, I think that was the big lesson of Vietnam for the American government and the way it wages war.
Okay. Do you think the United States has put Vietnam to rest, or is it still with us?
I think it's still with us.
How so?
You hear Democratic politicians criticizing President Bush and the situation in Iraq today as being a quagmire and like Vietnam and an endless war without any achievable objective or result. So I think the Vietnam still haunts our political discourse, and I think it will for another 25 years.
Do you think that's valid? Should it, or should it be put to rest?
Well, I think it ought to be put to rest because I think that was a war of its time and it was unique. And historical analogies don't always are not always the same. And I don't think the Vietnam analogy applies to the war in Iraq at all. So.
Okay. Mike, what do you think are the misconceptions or the myths of the American in Vietnam or the American soldier in Vietnam?
Well, I think the myth that he's a drug-crazed baby killer is a complete fabrication spawned by Senator Kerry and others. I think that's one of the big myths that came out of the Vietnam War. And the impact of that kind of news reporting and political discourse was very hurtful to the Vietnam veteran in the period after the war in this country, and the reputation of Vietnam veterans in the aftermath of the war. This is discussed in a great book called Stolen Valor by James Burkett. That phenomena. But I think that what was the rest of the question now?
Well, about the misconceptions and the myths of the soldier. And you addressed that.
Okay.
You addressed that. And you touched on a book there. What books do you think are good books, and which ones are bad books, if you've read them, on the Vietnam War?
Well, The Big Story by Peter Bastreth, I think is a good book. Stolen, Lost Victory by William Colby, I think is a good book. A Better War by Lewis Sorley, I think, is an excellent book. Vietnam, The Necessary War by Michael Lynn, I think, is an essential book on Vietnam. Books I don't think much of are A Bright Shining Light by Neil Sheehan, primarily because it doesn't discuss John Vann's pacification efforts in the Delta at all.
Right.
And there are other books that are discussed in in A Better War by Lewis Sorley that mentioned, that don't discuss that period late in the war from 68 to 73 and the success we had in Vietnam.
What about Vietnam movies? Have you seen them, and which ones are good?
I saw The Deer Hunter. I did not see Apocalypse Now.
Is that on purpose?
What?
Was that on purpose?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, I just didn't want to see it. Gardens of Stone, which I thought was a good movie. Hamburger Hill, which I thought was an excellent movie.
What was so good about that one?
It's realism. It portrayed infantry combat in the woods and mountainous woods of Vietnam as about as well as could be portrayed. So, anyway, I think that Hamburger Hill is about the best movie that's been made about it.
What about the more recent movie, We Were Soldiers?
Oh, I forgot about that one. Yeah, I thought that was a good movie for the first 80% of it, but then I thought it, because of the last 20 minutes of it, I thought were kind of fakey. So, I thought they messed the movie up by what they did the last 20 minutes of it.
Mike, what do you think about Vietnam today?
Well, let me for a second.
Sure. Take your time.
It was a climactic event of my generation. Its effects live with us today, and I think it profoundly affected my life. When I was in a law firm from 1981 to 1987, I was a Vietnam veteran, and that wasn't most of the other lawyers in the firm had found some way to avoid service in the military at all. And I think they looked down on me because I was a Vietnam veteran.
Do you think that still continues today with veterans, or has it changed with Vietnam veterans?
I think
veterans?
It's changed a little bit with Vietnam veterans.
Okay. Is it time that's helping that out, do you think?
Well, I think the passage of time has made the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And the realization in the country of how badly Vietnam veterans were treated after the war.
Mm-hmm.
So,
would you ever want to go back over there?
I've thought about that, and I would be kind of curious to go back to Canto and see it, but then again, I don't know that I'll ever go.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any contact with Vietnamese here in the United States?
Yes. When I left Washington, D.C., and came to Louisiana to take the bar exam, I met the former Chief Justice of the South Vietnamese Supreme Court, Tran Van Linh, who was a comparative foreign law librarian at LSU Law School. And we became friends, and we talked. I felt like we were both refugees at that time. I was a refugee from the military-industrial complex, and he was a refugee from Vietnam.
What did he tell you about his experiences?
Well, his experience was as a judge. And well, I'm trying to think of something I can say.
Well, overall, what was your impression of? I mean, was he bitter? Was he?
No, I think he was more resigned about his fate, about what had happened. He was able to get his wife out and his children out. So his children, one lives in Germany, and a couple live in the United States. This information is 10 or 15 years old.
Right.
We used to talk about what it was like in Vietnam, and I can remember him talking about a Vietnam program that was on television by Stanley Cornell, and his saying that it's communist propaganda. I don't understand how you allow people like that on your television.
Hmm.
And we talked about the terrorism in Vietnam and how there were hundreds of terrorist incidents against South Vietnamese people
mm-hmm.
by the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Okay. Mike, have you been to Washington to the Vietnam Memorial?
Well, I worked on the committee for a while
mm-hmm.
When I was stationed in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, all the committee's notes that I saved from that period are in the Vietnam archives.
Right.
I thought that in one of the meetings when we were discussing what what the monument should look like, I made the comment that it ought to be like the ones I'd seen in Germany with low black walls.
Mm-hmm.
That was about 6 months before the selection committee.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it turned out, which I was kind of glad it did.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Dubeck, who was called me and asked me, who was on the committee,
mm-hmm.
called me and asked me after they made the selection what I thought about it, and I told him they got it just right.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think a better representation of a political tragedy could possibly be designed. I think it's as good as can be designed. The only thing I would like to see there is some sort of statement that the soldiers died obedient to our nation's laws, which is similar to what's on the gravestone at Thermopylae, Greece, to celebrate the death of the 300 Spartans.
Mm-hmm.
And also to have taps played every day there by an army bugler.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a letter to the editor of the newspaper of the Washington Times, and it was published arguing that President Reagan ought to order taps being sounded every day there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was co-signed, I wrote the letter, but it was co-signed by Hugh Long, who was one of my friends from the Contract Appeals Division.
Mm-hmm.
And the Secretary of the Army liked it so much that he called in Hugh and complimented him on the letter.
Mm-hmm.
Hugh took credit for it. I was in Vietnam. I was in Lake Charles by that time.
Mm-hmm.
You told me about being invited by the secretary to come see him.
Hmm.
So,
what would have been your experiences there at the wall?
Well, I have one close friend whose name is up there, Cliff Moak.
Mm-hmm.
I found Cliff's name on the wall. I haven't shed any tears or anything like that, but I just... It's a tremendously emotional place.
Mm-hmm.
It's really something.
Well, Mike, is there anything else that you would like to talk about that we have not touched upon in our conversations?
Well, when I was stationed in Washington, I got mixed up in a big procurement scandal, and it involved some of the civilians.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember my Vietnam experience having a bad feeling about the civilians and that what they had done to the Army
mm-hmm.
during the McNamara era.
Mm-hmm.
And my reaction to the situation I was in was... I'm going to win this regardless of what the civilians want.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you might say, I had a MacArthur complex.
Mm-hmm. A MacArthur or a McCarthy complex?
No, MacArthur.
Okay.
That I would fight to win no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately we did.
You were a prosecuting attorney at that point?
No, I was a contract trial attorney.
Okay. Okay. Anything else?
No, I guess that's about it.
Okay. Well, this will end the interview with Mr. Mike Davidson. Thank you very much for your time, sir.
Okay.